Genesis 24, page 17. Page 17, starting verse 1. Now Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came? Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when women go out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today, and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink, and I will water your camels, let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master. Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please give me a little water to drink from your jar. She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and 2 bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? She said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. She added, we have plenty of straw and fodder and room to spend the night. The man bowed his head and worshipped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness towards my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman. Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out towards the man to the spring. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, and heard the words of Rebecca, his sister. Thus the man spoke to me. He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. He said, "Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside? For I have prepared the house and a place for the camels." So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, "I will not eat until I have said what I have to say." He said, "Speak on." So he said, "I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he has given all that he has. My master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to my father's house and to my clan and take a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Perhaps the woman will not follow me.' But he said to me, 'The Lord, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you and prosper your way. You shall take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. And if they will not give her to you, you will be free from my oath.' I came today to the spring and said, 'O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now you are prospering the way that I go, behold, I am standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes out to draw water, to whom I shall say, "Please give me a little water from your jar to drink," and who will say to me, "Drink, and I will draw for your camels also," let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son.' Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with her water jar on her shoulder, and she went down to the spring and drew water. I said to her, "Please let me drink." She quickly let down her jar from her shoulder and said, "Drink, and I will give your camels drink also." So I drank, and she gave the camels drink also. Then I asked her, "Whose daughter are you?" She said, "The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him." So I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her arms. Then I bowed my head and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me by the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. Now then, if you are going to show me steadfast love and faithfulness to my master, tell me, and if not, tell me, that I may return to the right hand or the left." Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, "The thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you, bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." When Abraham's servant heard the words, he bowed himself to the earth before the Lord. And the servant brought jewelry of silver and of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave to her brother and to her mother costly ornaments. And he and the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." Her brother and her mother said, let the young woman remain with us a while, at least 10 days. After that, she may go." But he said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." They said, "Let us call the young woman and ask her." And they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" She said, "I will go." So they sent away Rebekah with Rebekah their sister and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "Our sister, may you become thousands of ten thousands, and may your offspring possess the gates of those who hate him." Then Rebekah and her young women arose and rode on the camels and followed the man. Thus the servant took Rebekah and went his way. Now Isaac had returned from Beer Lahai Roy and dwelled in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field towards evening, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Yokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. The sons of Dedan were Ashurim, Letushim, and Leumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanoch, Abida, and Eldah. All these were the children of Keturah. And Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. And while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, eastwards to the east country. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham had purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. And after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Lahai Roy.
Thanks for reading, Rich. And can I add my welcome to you, Kevs? Great to have you with us this evening. As Kev says, we've been preaching through the life of Abraham over the summer, learning about the life of faith from the father of faith. I don't know if that sounds like something worth thinking about. I wonder where faith ranks on your list of life pursuits. I suggest, at least for the average Londoner, faith isn't nearly as high on the list as relationships. Fortunately, most of our passage today, you'll have noticed, is about finding the perfect wife. It's one of the longest love stories in the Bible. Maybe as we read it, you thought it was a little too long. And I'm sure some people do use it as Old Testament dating advice. And you could probably pick up some useful tips that way. Pray before you ask somebody out. O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today. I'm sure there are people in this room who have said words along those lines. Also, when choosing a wife, find a woman like Rebekah. Find someone who's kind and generous, who will offer to buy you a drink and will water your camels. But if we do that sermon, I think we will miss the main thing that God is trying to teach us through this passage. This is the last recorded act of Abraham before he dies. And it is often death, isn't it, which throws life into sharpest relief. When something is over, when we are forced to accept that life must come to an end, that's often what makes us ask the questions about the purpose of life, the quality of life, the measure of a life. Is our list of life pursuits in the right order? Could we, without realizing, be wasting our lives? And I think those are appropriate questions to ask in response to today's passage as we read about the death of the main human character so far in the Bible. But I want to suggest that this death is not a tragic death. In fact, it may be the first death in the Bible, which is almost positive. Did you notice how the author described it at the end of our reading? Look down with me at chapter 25, verse 7. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. 175 years on its own is a very good age, considering back in chapter 6, God limits a man's life to 120 years. He is going to be an old man, full of years. He has lived a full life. He has finished well. Rest in peace, Abraham. I think we are meant to say Abraham has the secret to living well. He can teach you how not to waste your life. There is a bold aim for our time this evening. How to die with no regrets. And you might think, actually, for a young crowd like us, death is just a distant concept of no immediate relevance. But maybe you read about P.C. Harper a couple of weeks ago, the policeman who was killed while on duty 1 month after he got married and aged 28. Sometimes life is cut short. So we really do need the answer to making it count. What is the secret, Father Abraham? Well, firstly, Abraham is a man who has learned faith. If you've been around for more than a few weeks, you'll remember that Abraham has been a pretty up and down character. But now that we're at the end of his life, the author seems to be painting a much, much more positive portrait. Last week was the proof that Abraham had made amazing progress. He showed faith in God, even to the point of being willing to sacrifice his son, Isaac. And this week, he continues to demonstrate that same faith in God's promises. Promises that he will be the father of a great nation through his son, Isaac. Promises that his descendants will inherit the whole land of Canaan, where right now they just live as sojourners and foreigners. Promises that God will bless him and through him all the nations of the earth. But what will happen when Abraham dies? Will the promises of God, which are largely unfulfilled at this point, will they die with him? Well, I think that is why Abraham takes so seriously his son's love life. If Abraham is going to have as many descendants as the stars in the sky, well, Isaac needs to give him some grandkids. And if Isaac's going to give him some grandkids, then Isaac needs a wife. So Abraham gets to work. Flick back to the start of our passage in chapter 24, verse 2. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac." It is a very important job, so he entrusts it to his oldest servant, the one he trusts with his household and his estate. And he makes him swear an oath of obedience to find Isaac a wife. And it's in some of the little details then of the passage where we see how much progress Abraham has made in his faith. Unlike his nephew Lot, for example, who was perfectly happy for his daughters to marry men of Sodom, Abraham is firm that his son should marry someone from his own family. I guess someone who will, by very nature of it, live therefore as a sojourner and a foreigner in this land, like Abraham. Unlike when Abraham abandoned Canaan, the promised land, to go to Egypt, he's not letting Isaac out of the promised land. He's not allowed to go with the servant to Mesopotamia. Verse 6, "See to it that you do not take my son back there." Even in a culture where arranged marriage is much more normal, the servant still thinks that it would make things easier if he was able to take Isaac with him to meet the girl. But Abraham reminds his servant how he was called by God to leave that place, and that God promised to give him this land instead. In fact, verse 8, I think, implies that it would be better for the servant to return empty-handed with no wife for Isaac than for Isaac to leave the promised land. If the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine, only you must not take my son back there." We've seen what happens when someone leaves the promised land, finds somewhere nice to settle down. Remember Lot's family in Sodom, Lot's own wife, who couldn't bear to leave the city and was destroyed. The lure to settle outside of the promised land is strong. Don't let Isaac go there. This will be the home of God's people now, the land of promise. The distance the servant has to travel probably isn't far off 500 miles, so it's very much like the Proclaimer's song. "But I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more, just to be the man who walks 1,000 miles to fetch a wife for my master's son, without letting him leave the promised land." It's not quite as catchy, but... And all of this in the hopes of finding a girl who is up for leaving her family to come and sojourn as a foreigner in Canaan. There's one other thing which I think the author uses to show us how Abraham's faith has grown. He has learned to trust the Lord's ways. He trusts the Lord, end of verse 7, to send his angel before the servant. But if not, that the servant will come back empty-handed and be free of his oath. Either the Lord will prosper this venture or not. And that will be okay. God will have another way to give Isaac a wife. I wonder if you can see how different that is to Abraham's DIY disaster with Hagar, Sarah's servant, back when he slept with her to try and produce a son for himself. In both of those cases, Abraham knows that God has promised him a massive family. In both of those cases, Abraham tries to act to bring about that promise. But this time he explicitly seeks God's help and hand in it all. And he is open to his own efforts, yielding absolutely nothing if it's not part of God's plan. Abraham is a man who has learned faith. And he's commended for it time and time again in the rest of the Bible. An uncompromising concern for the promises of God. Humbly, but actively pursuing and desiring to see those promises realized. Speaking for myself, I often think of faith too much as a one-time opt-in to the promises of God. Whereas it's presented here much more like Abraham's life's work. He's a wealthy man, he's well respected, but the thing that the Bible remembers about him, that he is commended for, is his faith. Faith is easily knocked down our list of priorities by more pressing concerns and desires. It's quite an interesting reflection for Londoners. Maybe you have moved to London because of the opportunities that this city has to do so much, to be in one of the most influential cities in the world. Think what you might achieve here. But I can still remember a line that Ed used earlier in this series. If we satisfy ourselves with the best that we can achieve, we will settle far short of the infinitely superior blessings that God has promised us. Careful that you are not wasting your life. That would be the worst thing, wouldn't it? To have wasted your life on something that never really mattered, when faith in God would have given you infinitely more. But sometimes we don't pursue faith because it's just too vague a concept to aim for. Have more faith is too hard to ground in any tangible change, so we just don't bother. Maybe we need to spend some time personally thinking what growing in our faith would look like for us. Maybe learning from Abraham's humility, even in the things that we do to bring about God's promises, to recognize that our way might not be God's way. Maybe learning from Abraham's resolve not to jeopardize the future God has promised for anything else, even when that's a more inconvenient and unconventional path to choose. His whole life has been shaped by his faith. The way he buried his wife last week. The way he cares for and prepares for his son's future this week. The way he leads and teaches his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. And maybe even more than Abraham's personal faith, which, let's face it, came to a climax back in chapter 22, the author seems to want to emphasize here the faith that he is leaving behind. The second marker of Abraham's well-spent life is a household who have learned faith. I was doing some thinking this week about what we leave behind when we die. And like me, you've probably heard the vague goals that people set of leaving the world a better place than when you entered it. The measure of a life is not its duration, but its donation. Now, with social media, it's possible to leave a digital legacy and preserve your ideas and comments and just a lot of information about you as a person. People are having to think about the digital inheritance that they're leaving for their descendants. We recognize that we have an impact on the people around us and the people after us. This is just the newest way of leaving a legacy. Well, you might have noticed that Abraham's not actually in the rest of chapter 24. The main airtime is given over to his nameless servant and his daughter-in-law. What is Abraham's legacy? What is he leaving behind? And what will become of the family of faith? Well, the servant obediently treks back to Mesopotamia, where Abraham's brother lives. And just as Abraham recognized it was God who would provide a wife for Isaac, so the servant prays in verse 12. O Lord, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink. And who shall say, drink and I will water your camels. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master Abraham. Again, just a reminder, this is not advice on how to know who God's chosen for you to marry. And the author isn't recommending the drink and camel test. But I think we are supposed to assume that he is trusting the selection process to God. The chosen wife will have to say the secret password, drink and I will water your camels, or she's not the one. And we heard the story earlier. Rebecca turns up. We find out in verse 15 that she's from the right family, Abraham's brother's line, although the servant doesn't find that out until verse 24. So he's in a kind of false suspense that we get to watch. Well, first she offers him a drink. Oh, will she be the one? And then she offers to water his camels. Oh, she's passed the camel test. And then finally he finds out whose daughter she is. And he finally knows God has granted him success. They go, they meet her family, and he tells them the whole story from the beginning. And they agree to give him Rebekah to be Isaac's wife. The author wants to show us that Abraham is leaving a legacy of faith behind him. The servant's prayer in verse 26, for example, shows his own personal faith. The man bowed his head and worshipped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness towards my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman. Not just the God of Abraham, but the Lord has led him as well. Earlier in Genesis, God impressed upon Abraham the importance of commanding his children and household after him to keep the way of the Lord, doing righteousness and justice. And we start to see that legacy in this servant who fears God and is living the life of faith himself. I think we also see good signs of faith in Rebecca. Her family understandably want her to stay for a bit, say their goodbyes. But she chooses to leave the land of her kindred and her country and her father's house. Are we supposed to hear echoes of Abraham's own journey away from his father's land to the land God had promised him? Rebecca's family definitely use the exact same words that God uses to bless Abraham back in chapter 23. The children and household of Abraham appear to be in good hands if Isaac has this wife and this servant. Interesting that passing on and passing down the promises of God comes up so early in the Bible. But of course, every generation has that responsibility because the human tendency will always be to drift away from the promises, to settle short of the promises, to doubt the promises. Each of us are called not just to strive for a life of personal faith, but also to guard the promises for the family of faith. And in that sense, the vague sayings that people use about life, they're not completely wrong. Leave the world a little better than you found it. It's just that our goal is people's faith. As Fran and I get ready, God willing, to become parents ourselves, we have to keep reminding each other that our first prayer for baby Ridgeway is not a safe delivery, it's not her health, it's not that she would one day get good GCSE and A-level results, it's not that she would get married and have a family of her own, it's that she would keep the way of the Lord, believe the promises of God for herself, and be part of the family of faith in passing on and passing down those promises. And I guess that's the way that we should pray for each other in the family as well. Don't stop praying for everything else, but pray first and most that we would be people of faith. Pray for the future of Euston Church. Kev is well advanced in years. One day he will breathe his last, hopefully when you're full of years. But pray for him. Pray for whoever is the minister of Euston Church after him. Pray for the ongoing faithful witness of churches across London and across this country. Don't take for granted that we will keep the way of the Lord. And I do really give thanks for people in this church. The huge list I could write of names. People who have encouraged me to a more wholehearted faith. And some of them have left now, gone to other churches across the world. It's possible many of us may have moved on in 5 years as well. But could you, in the time that you have here, try to leave Euston Church better than you found it? We will need you to urge us on to wholehearted faith, even if you are only here for a few years. But in case the weight of that responsibility causes you any worry or doubt, never forget that the future of the family of faith, the passing on of the promises, and their fulfillment is all in the sovereign hands of a God who is faithful. And that's where I want us to end this evening, reflecting again on the kind of God that we have faith in. How do you live the life of faith? By knowing the God you live for is faithful. God's role in our reading today is unmissable. Abraham knows in verse 7 the success of their mission depends on him sending his angel before them. The servant prays that the Lord would grant him success. In verse 21, he waits in silence to see whether the Lord has prospered his journey or not. And when Rebekah does pass the very bizarre wife test, in verse 26, the man bowed his head and worshipped the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness towards my master." And of course, if you miss all of those mentions the first time, you get them all again as he repeats the story. Verse 35, verse 40, verse 42, verse 44, verse 48. The Lord, the Lord, the Lord. Who is it that's found a wife for Isaac? The Lord has. Repeating the whole story, including every perfect providential detail, like the fact that Rebecca turns up before the servants even finished praying. We get all of that twice, so that we see just how perfectly God must have arranged this marriage, which is exactly the conclusion that Laban and Bethuel come to. Verse 50, Laban and Bethuel answered and said, "The thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." No surprise here, really. This is entirely consistent with the God who works the impossible to bring about his promises, exactly as he said he would. It's such an important lesson. It continues for the rest of the book of Genesis and for the rest of the Bible. What is the best way to build up a reputation for steadfast love and faithfulness to your promises? It's to set up the hardest opposition you possibly can, an impossible situation, and then to show that you can effortlessly deliver every time. How do we know for sure that God can deliver on his promises? He can give a 90-year-old woman a baby. he can give 300 men victory over massive armies. Abraham has even learned that he could bring a boy back from the dead if he needed to. Abraham has faith because time and time again, God proves himself faithful. So what will happen to the promises when Abraham dies? Well, why are you even asking the question? A little thing like Abraham's death isn't going to stop the God who makes the impossible possible. In fact, a sneak peek into the rest of chapter 25, it turns out that Rebecca, the perfect wife, is actually barren herself. Disaster. She was supposed to bear children for Isaac. How can a barren woman ever have children? Oh no, that's one of God's party tricks, isn't it? In fact, we learn that Rebecca is barren in verse 21, and by the very same verse, the end of that verse, she's already conceived two children. God always comes through on his promises. He is faithful. And there's none of the despair that time, no scorn or disbelief. Isaac just prays to the Lord, because we know by that point, he knows by that point, God makes the impossible possible. He's always faithful. If you are ever discouraged at the present state of God's people, if you are ever concerned about the fragility of people's faith, how will they keep believing God's promises for the future in a world that is ceaselessly trying to get us to pack it all in and settle for the present? Well, God is faithful, and he has kept the family of faith going for over 4,000 years. No barren wombs, no enemy armies, no weak and wavering believers are going to thwart God from fulfilling his promises. You cannot challenge the sovereignty of God in some new or unexpected way that he hasn't thought of. The faithfulness of God is irresistible. The book of Genesis ends actually with Abraham's great-grandson saying just that. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. If you don't yet personally know the God of Abraham, then take this from today. God is always faithful, and his promises would undoubtedly be fulfilled. So the only way to make sure that you haven't wasted your life is to shape your life around those promises.